Hi, my name is Jørgen Jørgensen. I'm the fourth generation owner and leader of Norrøna. I'm also a father and a husband and a passionate outdoor enthusiast. I really love spending time in the outdoors doing all kinds of outdoor activities, and I'm also passionate about building stuff, building things that high quality things that the consumers really enjoy.
Welcome to Norrøna Podcast. My name is Eivind Eidsrott. In Norrøna Podcast, we want to inspire you and facilitate great adventures in nature by meeting exciting people and telling fascinating stories. In this episode, we'll meet Jørgen Jørgensen, the owner and CEO at Norrøna. Jørgen is the fourth generation Jørgensen running this famous Norwegian outdoor brand. And in this episode, we'll get to know more about the exciting history of the company. It's a pleasure to welcome the CEO himself to Norrøna Podcast. Welcome, Jørgen.
Thank you.
You look great.
You too.
Do you come straight out of the mountains or something?
Yesterday.
Yesterday?
Mm.
So where were you?
I was in Sweden doing a bit of bird hunting.
Bird hunting.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Mm.
So tell us, where are we right now?
We're now in the Norrøna flagship store in Oslo. This is our first ever Norrøna store that we built in 2009 during the financial crisis, and we opened the 26th of November. And I mean, that was such a big moment for us to finally get the whole collection in one store.
It was a big celebration. I can remember that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big party as well.
A fantastic party.
Mm-hmm. And now it's almost 14 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So time passes.
Yeah.
Jørgen, in 2029, Norrøna celebrates its first 100 years in the outdoor business. What do we know about the beginning, all the way back in 1929?
Yeah, I mean, Norrøna was established by my great-grandfather. And he was a craftsman, a saddle maker. And he was very interested in creating products.
Yeah.
And before Norrøna, he actually started another company called Polar Bredesen og Jørgensen,
okay,
together with a companion. So that company actually became quite good size, making like medium-quality outdoor gear. But my great-grandfather, he was so passionate about quality stuff. So he actually pulled out of the company he founded in 1928.
Yeah.
And the 29th of April, 1929, he started Norrøna with the ambition of making the highest quality outdoor products.
That's great.
Yes, and he actually started just like 50 meters away from here, in the next, street here.
Here in downtown Oslo?
Yes, and he brought with him three sewers from the old company, and they started up with making kind of some gaiters, backpacks, and some outdoor accessories.
Yeah?
Mm.
Do you have any of those products still in your house?
Or? Yes, not in the house, but I have it in the office.
Yeah.
And it will be shown in our new Norrøna house.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to make some kind of a small museum out of that? Or?
Yeah, I think what's cool with the new Norrøna house, which will open the fall of 23, is that we will have a lot of storytelling showing a lot of cool things from the whole of Norrøna's history.
Yeah.
Mm.
Is it possible to divide Norrøna's history into different eras linked to which generation was in the driver's seat?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were established on making the highest quality outdoor products, like I said, but we also have three other building blocks. It's the functionality, design, and sustainability.
Yeah.
And all of these four building blocks can be linked to one part of Norröna. And kind of the first one we just talked about, and the second one, when we talk about functionality, it's actually back to when my father took over the company. I mean, he was he kind of took it over unplanned. His father again died quite suddenly. My father didn't have a lot of education. He was not really interested in outdoor. But when he suddenly were kind of sitting here with the responsibility of Norröna, he took sort of a life-changing decision that he really wanted to take this company to the next level.
Yeah.
And he did that by going back to the core. And as the expedition wave happened in Norway during the 70s, and Norröna was sort of in the loop with this all of these expeditions. And, you know, I don't think it was a strategy, but they started using the expeditions to test and develop new products.
Yeah.
And when they were happy, they put it into the store, and then it was a commercial product. So this is what we call extreme user-driven product development, and it's also how we still make our products.
Yeah.
So that's the second building block. And the third building block, it's about design. And that can, you know, we always had a sort of a clean and nice looking design, but in the year 2000, when I started working in the company, we brought that in as a signature and a point of differentiation. So when we developed the first Lofoten collection,
yeah,
you know, design was something new we added in there as the third building block. And out of this process came the loaded minimalism design philosophy, which is about making product as clean as possible, but with all critical details.
Mm-hmm.
And we also used design kind of in our communication and eventually developed the latest edition of the Norröna logo. But strategically, we want the design to be a differentiation point.
Yeah.
And the fourth building block, which is sustainability. I mean, some of the most sustainable things we've done is making high quality outdoor products that can last forever almost, and repairing them. But during, you know, year 2000 and the years to come, there was a bigger need to systematically work with sustainability. And eventually this became our roadmap, which is quite clear on all the parameters that we need to develop.
Yeah.
But the sustainability has been there from the start, but it's also been enhanced quite a lot in the latest years. So, you know, these four building blocks are also linked to maybe the four biggest areas or eras of the company's history.
We have to talk more about that roadmap later on. But if we just try to go back again, because you have such interesting history. And if we go back all the way to after World War II, when your grandfather, Bjarne Jørgensen, took over, do you know how it was for him to lead the company?
I mean, after the start, my great-grandfather, Jørgen Jørgensen, you know, he and he also had family members working there, and Bjarne came into the business after the war, like you say, and he took over and he kind of spread out the company quite a bit. So, it went into distribution, it went into camping, and widened it quite a bit. Still, we kind of won the first design award inside that period, and we added a lot of new product groups. We were doing, of course, tent from the start, but adding sleeping bags, adding more clothing. So the product portfolio grew quite a bit.
Yeah. I've seen some really great tents from that period.
Yeah,
and some really great ads as well.
Yeah. So it kind of, I would say maybe it became more like a general company. It kind of were less core than my great grandfather kind of when he started it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the switch when my father took over the company again was quite drastically. You know, we sold off a lot of what was not core outdoor, was sold off and went back to the roots and kind of into the high-end technical gear again. Mm.
And as you said, during the 70s, something really interesting happened because you had new designers on board and you had a new material coming in from another country. Tell us about the Gore-Tex Corporation.
Yeah, I can start all the way back for because right after my father took over the company.
And that was early 70s?
Yeah, he took over in 71.
Yeah.
And kind of during 72, he, you know, we're getting into it. And he was actually going to get married and, then the weekend. And right before he's leaving on the Friday, a guy called Thomas Karlström came into his office, and he was a Swedish engineer that moved to Norway to be closer to the mountain and his passion for the outdoors.
Yeah.
And they kind of found the chemistry right away. And Thomas became product developer for Norrøna, and together my father and him, they kind of started this extreme user-driven product development. My father almost didn't reach his wedding because he was so going into kind of the conversation. And I think, you know, what happened at this time, there's a couple of important elements before we get to the Gore-Tex jacket. Because we developed really great tunnel tents in 1972. And what is really cool that is we started to name the products with the kind of locations in Norway. So in 1972, Thomas Karlström was out with a tent Skarstind in front of the Skarstind Mountain. He was with Falketind in front of the Falketind Mountain. And, you know, that in 72 was when we started with this location names, which was very early and maybe even one of the first one if you look into the whole world. I haven't found anyone else kind of starting to use these kind of names at that time.
And later on the Ravneskar tent as well. Mm-hmm. That was my father's big dream.
Yes.
To buy the Ravneskar tent and to live the life that he could see in the Norrøna ads.
Yes.
In the 70s.
Yeah, they were great tents. And you know, with Thomas, he was also a very, you know, he was really into the climbing community. He knew a lot of climbers all over the world. And with him also, we kind of got into a lot of the expeditions. But the Gore-Tex story you're referring to, you know, it happened that I think it was Henry Barber that was sponsored by Gore-Tex with the first prototype of the jacket. He was in Hemsedal climbing with Thomas Karlström.
He was a famous American ice climber, right?
Yes. And Thomas got this magic material that was both waterproof and that could breathe. And he tested the jacket and he saw that, you know, under the straps of the backpack, he was still wet, but besides on the other side of it, he was dry. So this was really a fantastic material. And he called my father and said, we have to find some of this Gore-Tex. And my father eventually managed to call Gore-Tex in the U.S., and they shipped us 20 meters of fabric, and we developed the first three Gore-Tex jacket in Europe. Yeah. We didn't have the taping machines and so on, but we tested them, and you know, it looked really promising. And then Thomas drew out the Trollveggen climbing jacket and bib with you know, the high mounted chest pockets that didn't conflict with the harness. Mm-hmm. And they were really tailored towards big wall climbing. And then the products were tested out on Trollveggen on the Swedish route in 1979 with you know, really demanding winter condition.
Yeah.
And you know, ever since it's been a favorite for many, many climbers all over the world.
It's a legendary collection.
Mm.
And the Gore-Tex Corporation just went well after that. That phone call made it all.
And I think, you know, what is good with Gore-Tex and us, we always had great respect for each other and we have challenged each other many times, but I think a good partnership is about pushing each other forward.
Mm.
And they have been a loyal and long-term partner ever since. I'm actually in 2 weeks going to Gore-Tex to visit, and actually visit the family that owns Gore-Tex. So it's the first time I will meet them.
Okay.
So that will be really cool. It's also a family-owned business.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to kind of meet the family behind the brand that we
It's have still used the Gore family?
Yes.
So two great families will go together and have a dinner.
Yes, it will be really cool.
Your father, he was really a pioneer when it came to supporting different expeditions. Already in 72, also around his wedding maybe, he was in contact with a group of Norwegian climbers that had an idea to hire a car and then drive from Oslo to Afghanistan to climb one of the highest mountains there, Nushak. That's over 7,000 meters high. And do you know anything about how your father reacted to that idea and how he came to support the expedition?
I don't have the details for it, but it's probably, you know, a talk with him and Thomas. And, you know, my father always loved the highest quality. It's probably something in the blood. And I know that the feedback from expeditions, you know, they really wanted more durable and you know, stronger gear. And this was probably something that triggered his curiosity also, to be able to test out things on, you know, really pioneer expeditions.
Mm. And the guys, they came back with different diseases, but also some climbing success. And also a name for a new backpack.
Yeah, the Haddingla backpack, which was our strong, solid frame backpack that was developed during that time. And I mean, I always remember when I was young, because this was two packs. One was called Beito, and I mean, I grew up there, so I knew where that was. And then Haddingla, I never kind of got where's the link here until
where is Haddingla?
Until a few years later, that I okay, that's the link.
It's somewhere in the Hindu Kush mountain area in Afghanistan.
And I actually think it's as far as I can see the only Norrøna product name that is not in Norway.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something also you have to get into that museum as well.
Yes.
As a kid, I know that you had some of those great expedition members coming for dinner at your house. Can you remember that the four climbers going to Great Trango Tower in Pakistan came home to you?
Yeah, I mean, I was 11 when kind of before they left, and I remember we had a dinner where they were all kind of there and talking about the expedition, and I thought it was pretty cool to meet these guys.
This was Hans Christian Doseth, a famous Norwegian climber, and Finn Dæhlie, Dag Kolsrud, Stein Påsheim.
Yep.
And they had this insane idea to climb the highest wall in the world, the highest vertical wall in Pakistan. And they wanted to use the Trollveggen gear.
Yeah, and they were fully kitted up with Norrøna, with backpacks and everything. And I mean, I know they kind of found the wall on a picture from the year before when they kind of went down there.
Yeah.
And no one had ever been into the wall. I remember it was super budgeted. So I think Hans Christian, he kind of took a rope on the plane under his t-shirt to save some cost for extra weight.
Extra luggage.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was super core and super crazy to go in there. They had no idea of how demanding that wall was to climb. And I mean, of course, the book that Stein P wrote from the whole expedition, and then that they actually came up, two of them came to the top. And I remember still that from the news when you kind of heard, okay, they have been on the top, and then they started to come in, and where are they? They are lost, and what happened? So I really remember well that, you know, this was really emotional, and you know, that they suddenly they found them dead, and then they were wiped by the avalanche. Mm. So all of this kind of, you know, became very emotional, and you understand that, you know, expeditions and kind of all of this is, it has a risk. Mm. And I also know around that time, other climbers died. So it was kind of, we got aware of the risk and danger of the mountains at that time.
But at the same time, this was in 1984, at the same time as we had this both triumph and tragedy on Great Triangle, a famous Norwegian businessman called Arne Næss, he was planning the first Norwegian ascent of Mount Everest. And those guys, they were also at your house having dinner.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first dinner is, I remember very well. So the other one was also there, but and I think, you know, the expedition was really, really cool, and they, I think they had the most people on top of Everest
until that point.
I guess it was also the last time only one group was at Everest.
It was, there were a lot of Norwegians, but they had one British climber, Chris Bonington, and he said this is the happiest Everest expedition ever. I talked to some of the guys working at Noruna at that time, and they said that Noruna didn't have that much money, so there might have been sent a bill to the Everest expedition for some of the clothing. Do you think that's correct?
Probably.
So they were sponsoring the expedition, but it was also a small bill there somewhere.
And I think when you talk about sponsoring at that time, it was free gear. You know, it was not about the money. That came a lot later. And I think that was really shocking to my father, that you kind of should give anyone money to go on the expedition.
That was revolutionary. Noruna is so closely linked to Norwegian expeditions, not only to the mountains and not only to Himalaya, but also to the polar South Pole, the North Pole. And do you know and do you remember anything from the 1990 expedition where three Norwegians went out to go skiing to the North Pole?
Yeah, I mean, that was also another great expedition. And I guess this is the first time actually somebody came without an engine to the North Pole.
Noruna had been sponsoring the snowmobile expeditions earlier on in the 80s.
But I mean, another great expedition where they used the Arctic cotton and, you know, three very different persons. Børge Ausland, a little more quiet. Erling, he's not quiet. And so I think this was also another really cool expedition, and my father was really happy. I think they had had a front side of a national newspaper in Norway, and I mean, he was super happy with this expedition and the crew there. He was very proud of it.
And why did they use cotton in those long, long ski walks to the poles?
I mean, it's on the North Pole, it's very dry. So, and you don't have rain, very seldom snow. So, you really want something that breathes well, which is windproof. And this special Arctic cotton that my father developed during 1974, it was a special, very tight woven cotton that could replace polyester cotton. It was as windproof as polyester cotton, but the advantage was that it was breathing very well. So you could be out in dry condition. It's sort of the best materials which is there.
And Noruna is still making cotton jackets for those kind of conditions.
Yeah, and this one we actually took out of the collection a few years ago because we couldn't make it with organic cotton. But we are still looking at taking it back, this unique 300-gram, very tight-woven cotton. But we use a lot of cotton today. And I mean, when we think about products, we are not in love with one kind of material. We look at fit for use, and cotton is a fantastic material during dry conditions. It's very comfortable. It works nice. It gets a very nice patina after many years use. So we've always been very happy with cotton. Mm.
I think we need our own episode about expeditions. So we have to come back to all the other ones. But I have one question to our listeners, from our listeners as well. What kind of expeditions would you like to cooperate with in the future?
I think we, you know, looking at the history of how we've been extreme user driven, and we've been part of, like I said, many, many cool different expeditions. And they were all kind of based on, they came to Norröna because they thought Norröna could provide them with the best gear. So during the 70s, during the 80s, and during the 90s, this kind of was the fundament. Mm. But sometimes in the 90s, you know, came this, well, you guys need to pay to be part of that expedition.
We need money as well.
Yes. So the first time we actually paid money to be part of an expedition was when Erling Kagge went solo to the South Pole.
In 92.
Yeah, and it was a great expedition, and we got great publicity. But for my father, that was a big kind of, do I have to pay to be part of it? And I think Erling Kagge thought they got a really good deal and paid way too little. But of course, this developed, and eventually, I think when we're coming to the early 2000 and so on, the level of gear that was out there was sufficient for to do most stuff, you know. So it was all about who's paying the most.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were part of one expedition, and then that group went to somebody else, to the next expedition. So for us, it was important that the people we work with, they are in it with the heart. They want to work with Norröna, not because we pay them the most, but because their hearts say we would like to work with Norröna.
Yeah.
So we started changing from expeditions to ambassadors that kind of were tied up to Norröna over a longer period. And if they were on an expedition, we were part of that expedition. If they were out doing smaller stuff, we were part of that. So this mentality also changed in many other parts of the world, but I find this a really a good way of developing, working with people.
Mm.
So new expeditions, I think they have to be kind of innovative in a good way.
Yeah.
And we also have to be people that we can see us working long term with.
Mm.
So we don't want to be a part of only one expedition and then that's it. We would like to work long time with all our ambassadors.
Mm.
But I mean, you see stuff like Harila has done now. It is cool to see kind of new technology and new way of thinking just revolutionizing how things have been done before.
Yeah.
And it will for sure happen kind of in a lot of expeditions done before will be repeated in insane, I guess, time and speed. I mean, I think that's also cool to see, that we see innovation in the expedition world.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Did Kristin Harila call you before she went to all the 8,000ers?
Yes, so she's been in contact with us.
Do you regret that you didn't give her any clothing?
I mean, it's all about, you know, cost benefit.
Yeah.
And I think if we'd sat down long before and learned to know each other, maybe it could be differently. But I mean, we don't take kind of urgent decisions like that.
No.
And
she was in a hurry.
Yeah. And, it had to start long before she kind of started her expeditions for it to be interesting for us.
In the beginning of the new millennium, you started to work in Norröna yourself and brought with you brand new ideas and a new vision, as you told us. Could you tell us about your own background and what you did before you started at Norröna?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, my father brought me into the company when I was very, very young. So we're always part of kind of things that happened there. And I have a lot of memories from joining him around, if it's trade shows or kind of factory things or things like that. So I don't know if he had a plan, but he did it anyway. And he let me design my first jacket when I was 12.
I did.
And he made the first Norrøna jacket for me when I was 5. So I had a customized cotton, Nikkish and mountain jacket.
So Norrøna has been making clothing for kids for a long time.
Yes.
But only for one.
Yes. And that's been used by so many generations now.
Yeah.
And it just looks better and better.
That's good.
Yeah. So, but since I was very young, I like building stuff. So for most of my time, I have, wanted to work at Norrøna. I have a financial education. I've been also working in Skandinavisk Høyfjellsutstyr, which is a high-end outdoor shop in Norway. Before my studies, during my studies, and also after the studies, I was kind of responsible for purchasing and store operations. And what was cool about that, I learned a lot about our competitors because I did the purchasing with Patagonia and Arc'teryx and all that, all those brands. Yeah. And I was actually the first one to bring Arc'teryx into Norway. So I learned, a lot about.
And do you regret that?
No, I don't, because I think, it was very learningful. And I think they did a great job when they came with kind of their outdoor clothing. It was really impressive.
And brought something new to the table.
Yeah, and I mean, but I saw that, before anyone else. No one else had the sales statistics of how that sold out. And eventually that was also what kind of drove me back into Norrøna. Mm-hmm. I had also been on the board of Norrøna since 94. So I kind of got a lot of experience sitting in these board meetings and the strategy sessions. And I also have been working in the warehouse in Norrøna. And when I was young, I also did a lot of kind of gator work and sort of during evening shifts when I were forced to be work by my father. And that also led me to starting to playing with sewing machines because I was up there playing loud music and making these gaiters and maybe I should test out the sewing machine. So then I started sewing headbands and hats and gloves, and as I started making my own gear, so yeah,
customizing.
Yeah, and I actually sold the headbands. So that was first time I developed a business model.
And what kind of activities were you interested in that time? Skiing?
I started telemark skiing. I started skiing when I was much younger, but I started telemark skiing with Thomas Karlström when I was 11. And that was really cool, especially going out in the powder.
Yeah.
And we kind of had skins and were doing free riding and top touring, when I was 11, 12, 13. And Thomas brought us in many, many cool places and kind of into the pre-freeride community, which was telemark skiing at that time.
Yeah.
And I also, I really liked windsurfing when I was young and also outdoor activities, cross-country skiing, of course. Since I was working at Skandinavisk, I also were brought on the climbing courses and learn how to do mountain climbing, even if I think it's a little scary. So, and then general outdoor activities. My father liked fishing, so he brought me fishing a lot. And eventually, of course, later on, and now I do all the activities that Norrøna are making products for.
It sounds like you had a great general outdoor background.
Yeah, and I think all of this, I want to create stuff, the passion for the outdoors, the business degree, the learnings from Skandinavisk kind of were pushing me towards starting at Norrøna. It was only a couple of years where I kind of were interested in stocks and wondering to go that direction, but that didn't have anything to do with creating stuff, so I put that away. But, I wasn't done with the job at Skandinavisk. We hadn't been able to create that company profitable and so on. But with Arc'teryx and some of the other competitors being, quite innovative in the end of 90s, and my father had pulled out of the company towards the middle of the 90s, I think a little of the driving force of Norrøna disappeared with him not working there full time. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I started working there was to kind of spark the product development.
Yeah.
And yeah, why do you give a 27-year-old guy with no experience that job? I guess that was because I was in the family and very interested in product development.
And you also had the enthusiasm and the drive.
Yeah. And I still had learned a lot, you know, from being in strategy meetings with all the competitors. Mm. So I had a good insight in products and big passion for skiing. And actually had tried to give the product developers at that time, you know, my view and ideas,
yeah.
but they wouldn't take it.
So they said no?
No,
to your ideas?
Yeah, they didn't become executed. But
no.
But when we started, I started there. I think we there was a lot of low hanging fruits.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of actually great people that we brought into the creative process. And we saw that our kind of ambassador team needed a little refreshment, so we brought in found some really passionate skiers and free riders and brought them into the process. And I brought with, I read a lot about product development, especially a book from the founder of IDEO. And from that book, there was a list of 10 action points that says how okay. to make great products.
Yeah.
And I brought that 10 points and started developing this product this way.
That's great.
Mm.
And so, you followed the list.
Yeah, I never managed to do all 10, but 7 to 8 was we were able to execute on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and one of them said, use colors.
Use colors. That came from that book.
Yeah. And another one was, you have to make...
I had that question, you know, yeah, why did you yeah. use so bright colors?
Yeah, so and then the other one was how, you know, you have to make a metaphor for what you are developing.
Yeah.
So, and then we were going to develop the Lofoten. So this became loaded minimalism for the mountain. So that was the metaphor from Lofoten. And then we kind of developed Lofoten, we saw, this is the metaphor from the whole design we're doing.
It's a so great it became, metaphor.
Yeah. I mean, another one is you have to, the point is called think briefcase. And what you mean by that is that that's an identity for a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you create the product so it gets sort of an emotional feeling to the activity?
Yeah.
And I mean, we already had the names of the locations, but it ended up organizing them in collections. So it wasn't that many names, and you could put a lot more emotion into each kind of sub-brand.
Mm.
So therefore, we developed the Narvik collection and the Lofoten collection. It was also based on these 10 points.
Because Lofoten and Narvik, they are famous Norwegian ski destinations.
Mm.
Great nature, spectacular mm. nature. So you just had this idea to bring Norway to the market and then those
yeah, and, I mean, that,
famous names.
Yeah, I mean, we had all these famous names. And so a friend of mine, he looked at the catalog and he says, Jürgen, there are so many cool products here, but they have so many different names. And I don't understand the difference.
Mm.
So I tried to organize everything in a little differently.
Yeah.
And eventually came back to, yeah, you know, the names are great. We just need a little fewer ones. So
mm.
instead of giving each product a unique name, we give make a collection out of it and have the same name to the collection.
And when you started with the new Lofoten collection, did you have any feeling how popular that would be? That it would, in kind of way, define Norrøna today?
No. I mean, it was just a really fun process that we used a lot of, I tried to find product development methods.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to solve something together and use kind of an own developed method to develop the collection. And I understood we needed enough time to do it right. So you can, okay, it's not the right, we have to continue and continue until we have the right product.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually tried to make a kind of a free ride product before, but you know, we didn't do it properly, and the ambassador that was part of it, he never kind of, no, we need it to be different, we need to be different. He didn't have kind of a clear view. But when we got kind of Torkel Karoliusen and Bjarke Mogensen in there, they had so many ideas.
Strong skiers.
Yes. And they kind of had a lot of ideas, putting that with the design team and some of my old ideas from the past. And they were all innovative. You know, sometimes you meet ambassadors that want, they know something is really good by looking at others. But what was cool with Torkel and Bjarke and the kind of thing we created was we were all open to new ideas.
Yeah.
So, you know, we dared to do something different, which was not thought there. And there was no price target or anything. It was just about making the best ski jacket and the best ski pant for free ride. And it wasn't only for ski, because it we were no, non-political. It should work as good for ski and snowboard.
Yeah. Mm. And the price, it got a little bit high, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it came out... you know, higher than people were used to.
Yeah.
But still, the Lofoten, if we launched it today, it would kind of be a product that were all the way up there. So it was ahead of its time, and it had so many kind of cool new features, fit. No one used Gore-Tex for skiing at that time, you know. So this was, it was innovative to actually make free ride clothing, because that doesn't exist, but Gore-Tex was not used a lot on skiing. Mm. And of course, like you say, the colors. And the colors kind of came out of Bjarke and Torkel. They wanted to be seen on the, when they were filming.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was black and gray at this time. So they asked for, if you can make the samples in more colorful materials. And we had some cool colors that we kind of put together. And at the same time, this YKK water-resistant zippers, they just started coming in different colors. And then we choose kind of to contrast those zippers to make the product look really cool.
That's such a great idea.
Yeah, and the free riders, they really loved it. And usually at that time, you know, we had the products in one or two, maximum three colors. So the first generation was in two colors in 2004 when we launched it. And in 2005, we wanted to figure out which colors would sell best. So we made five colors. and we were going to take away the two or three that didn't sell, but they sold exactly the same, so we made all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we were kind of going in with the color, because then people liked this, and we continue going wider on the color and doing more and more crazy kind of combinations that we liked ourselves. And the cool thing with this was that every kind of, when you were down in the Alps and in Norway, you saw a colorful skier coming down a crazy place. You knew it was a Norrøna product.
It was the best communication and PR that you could have.
Yeah, and you saw, you know, in the ski area, everything was black, but these colorful, edgy new products came in, and only good free riders were using them. So that was really cool.
That's great. Mm. And you still have the Lofoten line, and it's still colorful.
Mm.
And it will be colorful for the rest of
When we defined the color strategy, for us it was not important to be colorful, but use the whole color range in a sophisticated, good way.
Yeah.
But this was so fresh to the market, so, you know, all the bright colors were what our wholesale customers bought, because it was so different and the consumer wanted it.
Mm.
So we had some earth tones and so on in Lofoten, some of the first editions of Lofoten also.
Yeah.
But that didn't sell because they wanted this different. So we will continue to have bright colors in Lofoten, but we will also mix in with other colors.
And
we like using the whole color palette.
Because you have some black jackets as well in the Lofoten line.
Yes.
Through the years.
Yeah, yeah. So we have black and the unique black and white piece. But we always have a strategy, and any color we use, it's not a coincidence. It has some thoughts and behind it. And, you know, we try to make the color so that they can work across the collection, but also across time. So if you buy a jacket today and you buy a pants in 3 years, it's not a perfect match, but they should still look good together. It's a, that's a tough ambition, but this is still how we think.
Yeah. I had this pink one piece Lofoten and I had the courage to wear it for a couple of times. I don't have the courage no longer. Did you wear that yourself? And do you still have it?
I might have it, but I don't think I have it.
Is there some kind of age limit on that product?
Yeah, I think at least a skill limit.
You have to be a good skier.
You have to be rocking.
That's a good one. When you took over, did you want to take over the company?
Yeah. So
that's I a think definitely,
Yeah, so I forced my father to kind of do the generational change.
It was your initiative to take over.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been then working in product development for 4 years. And I saw that if we were going to succeed kind of internationally, at that time, you know, in year 2000, Norena didn't have much export. We actually, back in the 80s, we had a 30% export share, but during the 90s, we were so successful in Norway with the outdoor market exploded, and they exploded with the demand for Norena products. So we didn't have enough capacity to fill the Norwegian market even. So we were kind of producing so much just to keep up with the Norwegian market, we forgot all the export. But when we kind of wanted to refresh ourselves in early 2000, we had a big discussion about, you know, what should Norena be? And my ambition has always been to make the greatest outdoor products. You know, we should not be the biggest, but we should be kind of the best.
And it's a bold ambition.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's in the blood. You know, that's what we are passionate about, making products that people say, you know, this is the best stuff I ever wore. And if we want to be credible on making the best, we also have to succeed outside Norway. And our Turex and all those, the other neighbors sort of challenging our premium position in Norway. So
you wanted to challenge their position back in Canada and the U.S.?
Yeah, and even for Norwegians, if we are successful in the U.S., they can believe that we have the best products in the world. If we cannot do that, it's hard to be believed on that. So the discussion kind of, or to succeed internationally, it requires, I understood it requires a lot, but it required even more than I understood. But I saw that we needed to work differently in the whole company. And I believe that I had to execute on that. So therefore, after some long discussions with my father, I said, now I'm ready to, you know, take over the company and run it from here. So after some time, he agreed, and we decided on the kind of generational change.
And how did that feel? How did it feel to take that responsibility?
I never really were afraid of taking responsibility, so it actually felt natural and good. But at the same time, you know, right after I we agreed that I should take over 1st of January 2005, my father became ill, and he got cancer, and eventually it showed that it was a cancer that you couldn't do anything with. So, I mean, he died only 1 month after I took over the company. So that was, of course, very emotional. And now I was like 31 and didn't have that much experience and kind of no one else to talk to. So luckily I got an external chairman, which his name is Christian Stable Eriksen, and he came in December 2004. And he had experience in running a family-owned company, and he had he's a very straight shooter. He was there to help me, not to not as a job, but so he's been a very good mentor all the way since that time. And he was very tough towards me, So he said, you know, you need to create a kind of a team that wants to play in, that can play in Champions League if you want to play that league. Mm. You should do that kind of right away in 2 months. And it took me 5 years, so I wasn't that quick on executing all his recommendations, but eventually I got them.
Yeah, and he's still the chairman?
He's still the chairman. Mm.
And he still gives you good advice?
Yes.
Yeah. But did you feel still a little bit alone when your father passed away and you sat there with the whole company in your hands?
I think... kind of the frustration of not being able to execute of what I thought was right before kind of made it more like, finally, you have the freedom to go and execute on what you think is right.
Now you could decide. Mm-hmm.
I think during that period also, and I mean, I still do approximately 50-50 correct and, you know, right and wrong. And no one kind of give me like, why did you do that? Because I'm on top. Mm-hmm. But I still use this, you know, it's the best way to learn from your mistakes. Mm-hmm. And in 2007, we launched maybe the most innovative Lofoten line ever. And we still kind of did development all the way until production started. So we tested out things. And it was a new pro shell, and there was a lot of kind of mistakes we also did, even if the products looked very innovative. Mm-hmm. And at this time, we moved a lot of production from Europe to Asia. So, I mean, we had 11 factories. They were all massively late. And part of the quality was bad. And we had to cancel a lot of orders and take back a lot of products. And I just hired a new supply chain manager that was supposed to kind of fix all this, and he quit. you know, then that was, I think, the toughest time I had in Norena, kind of, oh, this is going to be tough.
Yeah.
But it's also, now it's maybe the most valuable lesson, because we didn't blame anyone else, kind of looked in the mirror and says, kind of, yes, you created this. You learn from it and fix it.
Yeah.
And I think this is the most valuable lesson and also the hardest one I had during my business life.
Yeah. Mm. But you dare to make mistakes.
I mean, you naturally do it. I mean, everyone makes mistakes, but at least you can kind of put them back in the learning curve and try to do it differently next time.
It's human to make mistakes. Do you know how you and your team would like to take the load and minimalism design philosophy, this great philosophy? How would you like to take it further into the future?
That's a very interesting challenge. I mean, I think the next 5 years, maybe even longer, the innovation will happen a lot on the sustainability part, which is not necessarily visible. That's kind of easy to look at the numbers and figure out how you have to innovate in sustainability. But I think this the challenge you said, how do you continue to innovate? It's a tough one. Like the Lofoten collection, when I use it now, it's hard to come up with kind of new ideas because it really does
it's
the
so
job.
It's so good.
Yeah. But I think one way of innovating is kind of going into another activity. And it's also kind of our history that we've been early movers in new activities.
Yeah.
It's kind of how we have innovated. And by going into a new activity, you get some new ideas and features and you bring them back into old activities. So, I mean, going into trail running, for example, even if that's not necessarily a new activity, I think we have approached trail running in a different way. Mm-hmm. It gives new insight, new input. And I think the Senja, you know, Flex One shorts, trail running is about lightweight, minimal things. It should be very clean, but you still have so many features at that shorts. And it's still so lightweight and so good to use. Mm. You know, here is some learning we can bring back into the, you know, free ride collection. Mm. But it's also about, you know, slightly adjusting the innovation process that we have. You know, it's how do you stay hungry? How do you kind of dare to try something new and fail and then continue to play to... That's a good way of developing new stuff. Mm. So I always think I have this fear of not being able to be innovative. And especially, I think, when you go to the eSport trade shows, what's good about that is you see all the competitors aggregated. Yeah. So you get a little panic, and that is very motivating when you get home and you sort of, we have to speed up.
It's motivating to get a little bit frightened.
Yeah, I think that's... If you're not frightened, it's hard to kind of be on your edge.
Yeah. Mm. Thanks a lot, Jörgen. Mm. In the next episode, we'll talk more about your leadership, your current ambitions, and your thoughts about the future in general for Noronha. And we'll ask you some questions from the Noronha customers as well. Looking forward to that one.
Yeah, thank you, Ivan.
Noronha Podcast is published by the Norwegian outdoor company Noronha Sport. Noronha has been producing premium outdoor products since 1929. Check out our clothes, backpacks, tents, sleeping bags, and skis on our website noronha.com. There, you will also find more inspiring stories about our rich history, the expeditions we have participated in, our ambassadors, and our ambitions in sustainability. Thank you for listening to Noronha Podcast. We really appreciate it. And welcome to nature.